It's Saturday afternoon. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio, or perhaps to the podcast, wherever you are, however you're listening. Thank you for joining me, Justin Brierley, for Unbelievable. And every afternoon on a Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio, we bring you some kind of engaging, certainly brain-engaging debate on Christianity and atheism and other worldviews. And we've got a corker for you today, as one of the guests joining me for Unbelievable, the Conference 2014, appears on today's show. He is Clay Jones. We're going to be meeting him, finding out about his back journey and what we're going to be talking about today, the problem of suffering. But if you're not already booked in and you're interested in finding out more about this year's Unbelievable Conference, it's only 3 weeks away now, Saturday the 12th of July at Methodist Central Hall in Westminster, London. Reasonable Faith in an Uncertain World, and presented by Premier and Biola University and in partnership with Reasons to Believe. And Clay is among a list of highly renowned speakers: William Lane Craig, Oz Guinness, Craig Hazen, Tanya Walker, Jeff Swearing, Ruth Jackson and David Robertson also on the bill. And some fantastic things to tell you as well, if you haven't quite decided whether you're coming or perhaps you're bringing a group. Not only are we giving the Biola DVD with lectures and resources and things available on it to delegates who book two or more tickets, every delegate will also receive a Reasonable Faith DVD featuring some of Bill's debates, William Lane Craig's debates here in the UK, such as the Cambridge Union debate. So that's something that's just been agreed in the latter stages of planning. And so it's great to be able to confirm that. So if you come along, you'll get a goodie bag. You'll get things like Premier Christianity magazine in it, info resources, but you'll get this fabulous Reasonable Faith DVD as well. So what better reason to book now if you haven't done so already? premier.org.uk/reasonable faith. Again, that's premier.org.uk/reasonable faith. Persuade someone to come along with you, and then you'll actually get that other DVD as well, the Biola DVD. So book in, and it'd be great to see you. So much going on the day, so many different lectures and seminars. We're looking forward to having Oz Guinness join us, and he's with me on the show next week as well. His opening address is, "Can we change the world, or is that only a cliche?" And then he features in the programme later on. As ever, premier.org.uk/reasonable faith to find out more. Looking forward to meeting you on Saturday the 12th of July. For now, let's get into our programme. You're unbelievable. It's the problem of evil today. Perhaps the most common objection to Christianity is, why would an all-good, all-loving God allow the level of evil and suffering we see in the world? So we're asking today, does the existence of evil defeat belief in God? And as I mentioned, I'm very pleased to have on the show today Clay Jones, Associate Professor of Christian Apologetics at Biola University. He's actually a former talk show host himself, a former host of Contend for Truth, which is a national call-in radio program in the States, currently writing a book on why God allows evil and speaks widely on the subject. As I mentioned, he's coming over for Unbelievable, the conference, in a few weeks' time. And Clay will be speaking on why God allows evil and also the Old Testament as well, some of the issues that often arise in terms of some of the moral issues in the Old Testament. That's all part of our big question stream at the conference. My other guest today is Richard Norman, who is appearing, I think, now for the third time on the show, an emeritus professor of moral philosophy at the University of Kent. He's a founder member of the Humanist Philosophers Group and a vice president of the British Humanist Association. Great to have you on the show, Clay. Perhaps we can start with you. You're currently out in California with the Biola team, but do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and how you fell into the world of defending the Christian faith and specifically teaching on apologetics?
Well, background-wise is kind of a bizarre, or maybe it's not that bizarre to people today. We live in such a melting pot of religious ideas. But growing up, my father was an atheist and my mother was an astrologer, and together we attended the United Methodist Church. When I say my father was an atheist, I remember, you know, I mean, he may have said, well, I'm really an agnostic, but I remember walking by and seeing the book God is Dead on the shelf, and he had nothing to do with Christianity, was not interested in it. The reason we went to the Methodist Church, where the pastor really didn't believe anything that he was saying, was just because he thought that some sort of church influence would be good. My mother was completely committed to the occult. Thankfully, when I was a teenager, my dad became a Christian, and changed completely because he was a hard drinking, gambling, womanizing kind of guy. My mother then followed suit not long after that. And I think that the thing that it did is I was immediately, and this is quite a long time ago now, I was immediately interested in truth, religious truth claims. Because it's like my dad thought my mom was nuts while she was into the occult. And my dad, like I say, was a hard drinking, womanizing kind of guy. And so this, it just was very interesting to me right off the bat. Just as a teenager, I became very interested in Christian apologetics, and then I got a BA in philosophy, and well, and here I am. So that's what interested, got me going in all of this.
It is a really interesting story and background that you've come out of there. When it comes to the particular issue that we're going to be looking at today, Clay, in your experience, and it's been a wide-ranging experience, especially, you know, having been a talk show host yourself, does this issue, I guess, come up time and time again in your experience?
Well, of course, it comes up time and time again, and it's not the place now for me to go. I could go on for 20 minutes about how I got into just this topic, But frankly, I think that there's two major things, and it's interesting because D. Martin Lloyd-Jones, who was used to teach in Westminster Chapel, but while he was alive,
just down the road from us here at
he put it very well. He says our problem, we suffer from a double failure. We fail on the one hand to understand the depths of human sinfulness, and we fail on the other hand to understand the height, the glory, the wonder of what awaits the Christian for eternity. I found in my own life that that's really the major problem when people come to the problem of evil, that they don't really agree with the depths of human sinfulness, neither do they have any comprehension. In fact, it's interesting to me, but eternity hardly figures into the debate often. But for me, it does. Eternity is very significant when it comes to this.
Well, we'll obviously get into that in the course of today's program. But really happy that you're joining us, though, to be able to take a longer look at it in more detail, obviously, at the conference. Not only that, though, what to do with the Old Testament is another of the seminars you'll be leading at Unbelievable, the conference on Saturday, 12th of July. Do you want to just give us a quick flavour of the kind of issues you're going to be attempting to help us think through on the day?
I'm going to go through four issues when it comes just to evil. Why do we suffer for Adam's sin? Does that in any way, shape, or form make any sense at all? We'll be talking about that. I'll be talking about the nature of humankind. Are humans born, you know, neutral to the world morally, or are they born fallen? I'll be answering that question. We'll talk about the value of free will, and ultimately then I'll talk about what God's doing with all this evil and suffering and in heaven forever. Then when we get to the Old Testament, I've written a couple of articles now, and I'm working on a third one. I published a couple of articles on why God ordered the killing of the Canaanites, because this is kind of a part of the problem of evil thing. If God is good, how can he command these things? And so I'll be talking about issues particularly related to probably the number one objection to the Old Testament is God's order to kill the Canaanites.
Yeah, not an easy one at all to tackle, but appreciate you coming over to put your mind to that one, Clay. Anyway, let's introduce our other guest, Richard Norman. Richard, thank you for coming back on the program.
It's a pleasure.
We've had you in a couple of debates really looking at things like the argument from beauty and things like that. So we're turning to something, as it were, is more an argument against God today.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You're an atheist. Has this argument particularly been influential in your own thinking and your reasons for being an atheist, the argument from evil?
Only as part of the total picture, really. It's not as though the phenomenon of evil suddenly, you know, impinged on my awareness and suddenly made me change my ideas. I should say that though I don't share Clay's exotic and exciting background, the one thing I have in common is that I went to the Methodist Church when I was young, and like him, got involved in thinking about the philosophical problems, the evidential problems, and so on. But really, what it amounted to was just that as I grew older and as I thought more and more about these things, I just decided that there certainly weren't good enough reasons for the beliefs that I'd previously held. So it wasn't a dramatic conversion in the light of some It was sudden awareness of, for example, the extent of evil and suffering in the world, but just a matter of thinking it through.
Yeah. In your experience, those who perhaps have had a more faith-based beginning to their life at some level, do you find that this argument does play into that? Among your students, is it a common thing?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think it is absolutely fundamental to the problems that Christian doctrine has in explaining the world and explaining our experience. But it's part of the total picture.
Yeah. Sure, mm. Sure. Well, we're just addressing, in that sense, part of the big picture. And I wonder, perhaps, if you would like to get in touch yourself, you're listening and you're thinking, I'd like to contribute in some way, respond to anything you hear on today's show. You can, of course, email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be delighted to hear from you, or you can send in your tweet or your Facebook message, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, or tweet me @unbelievablejb if you want to follow me on Twitter. I'd be delighted to hear from you and to know what you think about today's programme. And again, if you want to check up on my guests, links to them and so on, all available via the Unbelievable webpage at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Today on the show, we're talking about the problem of evil.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, this is the way that I think David Hume put it, paraphrasing Epicurus. He said, is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is not omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Then whence cometh evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? One way, I suppose, of framing this question that we're looking at today on the show, does the existence of evil defeat belief in God? It probably is the most common objection to Christianity, goes back to the earliest days of classical philosophy and so on. Well, why don't you kick us off on this, Clay? And maybe, given that this is an argument against God, you could start with giving a positive case for why maybe God does have good reasons for allowing evil. And then we'll obviously bring in Richard as we go.
Very good. Yeah, I'm thankful. I'm thankful to be able to talk with you, Justin, and Richard today about this. Let me just give a relatively brief explanation of where I'm coming from. Right off the bat, I'd like to say I don't know what Richard's position is on this particularly, but I think the listener may find it interesting to note that the majority of atheist philosophers have concluded that the logical problem of evil fails to rule out belief in God. Let just give three examples real quick.
Do you want to just explain what the logical problem is? Because I think many people will be unaware that this argument does take different forms and that there is this so-called logical problem of evil and the what you might call evidential or probabilistic problem of evil.
The logical problem of evil is that there's actually an internal contradiction between the premise if God is all good, he would desire to be that there would be no evil, and if God is all-powerful, he'd be able to prevent evil, but evil exists, and as you were quoting from Hume, there's a lot of different formulations of it. This is just one off the top of my head. Well, either God's not all good, or he's not all-powerful, or he doesn't exist, is basically what they say the argument is, and this is the logical problem of evil, trying to show one of internal contradiction. But as I said, most philosophers have given up on the logical problem of evil. We'll get into the evidential in a moment. And, for instance, atheist J.L. Mackey wrote, quote, we can concede that the problem of evil does not, after all, show the central doctrines of theism are logically inconsistent with one another. Similarly, atheist William Rowe concluded that the logical form of the is not much of a problem for theistic belief. And finally, atheist Draper wrote, I agree with most philosophers of religion that theists face no serious logical problem of evil. And so when it comes to the logical problem of evil, most atheists have gone, it just doesn't work.
Just give us a brief kind of sketch then of why that particular attack or argument has been dropped essentially by most philosophers as far as you're aware.
One of the major reasons actually, and people that are in this subject at all know about this, is the work of Alvin Plantinga, and some others, but Alvin Plantinga primarily has, I think, did a death blow to it, because he just simply constructed the, put out all the premises in a very logical form. And, well, frankly, apparently most atheists that used to engage with the logical problem of evil in reading Plantinga's arguments went, I think he's, you know, he's right. We can't use the logical problem of evil anymore. That there's just simply ways out of it.
There's no way, as far as I understand it, of being able to conclusively show that God could not have some ultimate purpose.
That's right.
Which could give a feasible reason for him allowing evil and suffering.
And Plantinga's argument was basically along the lines of the free will defense. In fact, one of his major books on it was God, Freedom, and Evil. And he laid out an argument from the free will defense, basically saying God wanted to create beings with free will, and these free will beings are doing what they want to do. And he then said, I'm not saying this is the way it works, for sure, but what if it turns out that all the natural evil in the world is being caused by these powerful evil forces like Satan and his minions? I don't think that that is the cause of all the natural evil in the earth, but that wasn't his point. He was just simply trying to show that there's not necessarily a logical contradiction here. And I think, like I say, most atheist philosophers, like I said, I don't know what Richard thinks about this, the logical problem, but most atheist philosophers have given that up, the logical problem. But then that brings us to the other one, and that is the evidential problem. Most atheists now appeal to the evidential problem of evil, which argues that although the amount of evil in the world doesn't rule out the possibility of there being a good God, the amount of evil in the world makes it unlikely that a good God exists. Yeah. And so in other words, they're saying we can't say that it's logically that there's a knockdown, certainty here. That was what the logical problem of evil would have granted. But it's still the amount of evil in the world makes it unlikely God exists. And that's the evidential problem.
So it's more that they'll say it's improbable. It's not impossible, but it's very improbable. At some level.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe it would be good just to allow Richard just to, I think, maybe comment at least where you stand, and then we'll come back to Clay on this. You're aware of this distinction between these two arguments, I'm sure, Richard. Do you think Clay's sort of formulated those sort of more or less accurately?
In a sense, but I think a little bit more needs to be said. I mean, I guess what I'd say really is that the logical problem of evil, once you start to think it through, any interesting version of it turns out to coincide with the evidential problem. Let me put it this way. The starting point, as you say, with that quotation from Hume, is the incompatibility of a massive amount of unmerited suffering in the world with the idea of a deity who is omnipotent and loving. Other kinds of religious belief would have no problem with it. I mean, the ancient Greek religion, which saw the world as the arena for warring deities who weren't particularly concerned about human well-being, no problem. So it's very specifically that Christian monotheistic conception of religion that has the problem of evil. You can try to deal with the logical problem by constructing theodicies, accounts of why, despite initial appearances, actually we can give a good explanation of why an omnipotent and loving God would create a world with that kind of suffering in it. I think that none of those theodicies work, and we can talk about them, but the free will defense and so on, I don't think that they work. Now, where that leaves us then is not, as it were, a total logical refutation of the idea of such a God. Where that leaves us, I think, is that all that the Christian can say, confronted with the failure of the theodicies, is, well, we can't explain it. We believe on other grounds that there is such a God. We don't know why he allows that degree of human suffering. It's a mystery. Now, insofar as that position is always open to people, the problem of evil doesn't logically rule out the existence of such a deity. But that's where the problem then to...
So in a sense...
But again, I mean, nothing would logically rule out the existence of a deity. It just means that there is no good reason for believing in the existence.
In that sense, at some level, every atheist is agnostic. They couldn't rule out God per se, but they would say it's highly improbable, or you would say at least it's...
Well, yes, but the kind of agnosticism that says actually we don't have good reasons for believing this, and so we should act on the basis of the conclusion that we have, you know, that we can rule it out
for
practical purposes.
Though you would
concede, you can't show there's a think you can show there's a logical contradiction in the very idea of a deity, or even in the very idea of an omnipotent and benevolent deity.
And to that degree, you would concur, at least at the level that you couldn't show a logical impossibility when it comes to this argument.
But to avoid the logical possibility, what you have to say, I think, is we simply cannot explain it from a Christian standpoint. It's a mystery. We have faith in God's purposes, but we don't know what they are.
Well,
only logically coherent position.
Well, I have a feeling Clay kind of, I think, goes a bit beyond that and suggests, well, perhaps there are ways of thinking through it.
And I think that's the differences between them. But that's why I say, in the end, it turns out to the into the evidential problem. Well, what's the best explanation for a world of the kind that we live in, where there seems to be so much unmerited human suffering?
Well, let's come back to you, Clay. Do you want to just briefly sketch out your positive case before we go to a break for why God may have good reasons for allowing evil, what you might call in the technical terminology, which you've already used there, Richard, a theodicy in that sense? Do you want to start doing that, and then we'll...
Yes, I'd like to do that.
Go ahead.
Let me just clarify something at the outset. Some listeners might complain that they don't agree with some or all of the things that are taught in the Bible. I'm actually do not appeal to mystery. I think that we know why God allows evil. I think the Bible tells us, and I'm going to be presenting the biblical case for why God allows evil. But some listeners, like I say, may go, well, but I don't agree with the things taught in the Bible. I understand that, but that's an entirely different debate. If you want to know why the Christian thinks God is right to allow the evils he allows, then the Christian is going to have to appeal to the Bible. And the fact that the skeptic doesn't agree with that explanation isn't relevant if they don't agree with, they say, yeah, but I don't agree with the Bible. But that's not the point. Okay. The Christian isn't trying to defend a God that the skeptic will agree with. Other speakers at the event that you have coming up, Justin, that I'm going to be at, are going to give evidence as to why the God of the Bible exists, but that's not what we're doing. So anyway, very briefly, here are seven, and it's pretty brief.
I love it. Briefly, here are seven.
Anyway, seven.
That's going to be one a minute, okay?
That's about right, about 1 minute or even less. First, God chose to create beings with free will, and it is impossible even for God to create free beings without allowing those beings to use their free will wrongly. For example, a man can't tell his daughter that she's free to go out on a date, but then chain her to the oven. Free will requires that a being must be able to use it wrongly. Secondly, God created Adam and Eve as real individuals with free will, warned them that death was the consequence of using their free will wrongly, but then they rebelled against God. And after they rebelled against God, God then cursed the ground, enabling all kinds of pestilence. And then he removed them from the Garden of Eden, and that prevented their access to the rejuvenating power of the Tree of Life. And we've been attending funerals ever since. Third, and related to that, of course, is that natural evil then, which includes everything from mold to tsunamis and earthquakes and cancers, etc., are largely the result of our living in a cursed world. Fourth, although God could regularly intervene to stop various types of suffering, God doesn't want to do that because he wants humans to learn the consequence of rebellion. He wants them to learn the consequence of their own actions, which is life without his constant protection. Fifth, I'm almost done, see? As Richard Swinburne has pointed out, natural laws must work in regular ways if our actions are to mean anything at all. Otherwise, you could have Bobby and Billy sitting at the dinner table, and Bobby could be cutting his steak with a steak knife, and all of a sudden he could take his steak knife and jab it into Billy, and God could make the steak knife turn into rubber, and the whole family could just laugh heartily at how that occurred. But that's not a real world. That's a cartoon world. God could regularly interrupt the laws of nature, but that's not, he's not interested in that because then our actions wouldn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. Sixth, the knowledge we are learning here about the consequences of rebellion against God is preparing us to be fit citizens of God's kingdom, where we're going to have free will, but choose not to sin because we've learned that sin here is stupid. Mm-hmm. And seventh, my final comment on this is those who learn that rebellion is stupid and then trust Jesus will be given eternal life. And that eternal life, very important point, will dwarf our sufferings to insignificance. So anyway, there it is. Yeah. Now, I realize that's a lot of stuff said very quickly. When I teach Why God Allows Evil, which I do every semester at Biola University, I get to unpack this for 24 hours. So, I gave a lot of points in 3 minutes. Well, obviously there's a lot to unpack.
Indeed. But, we won't attempt to, as it were, unpack all of that in the course of today's show, but perhaps we'll take some of maybe the most, the typical sort of issues that very often arise. So free will, and should God intervene against natural laws and so on. And I think this issue about eternal life, which, as you say, Clay, doesn't often feed into this argument, but this idea that actually the suffering we experience now perhaps needs to be set against the ultimate sort of everlasting life that's promised in God and so on. So, I think we've plenty to get going here, and we'll come back in a short moment's time to hear what Richard has to say on a few of those, and we'll get this discussion going. It already is going, really, in many ways, isn't it? As we're looking at the problem of evil today on Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Does the existence of evil defeat belief in God? We ask. Clay Jones from Biola University joins us. He's currently writing a book on this very subject. And if you want to find out more about Clay, clayjones.net. He's also around on Facebook if you want to look him up there as well. You can find out more about Richard Norman and the Humanist Philosophers group that he's part of at humanism.org. And don't forget those links and more available from the website of Unbelievable. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And look forward to connecting with you if you want to send in an email and so on. So we'll be back in a moment's time here on Premier Christian Radio as we continue today's discussion on evil and suffering and whether there is a Christian response to it.
Was Jesus really raised from the dead? How can we know that God exists? How do we explain evil, pain and suffering in the world? And can faith be reconciled with modern science? Few universities are bold enough to answer yes to all these questions, but California's Biola University is premier amongst them. Biola University offers distance learning graduate degrees in theology, science, and apologetics that answer the toughest questions people ask about your faith. So to get the confidence you need to stand for Christ in a cynical age, visit biola.edu/apologetics. That's biola.edu/apologetics.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back this Saturday afternoon to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. And still to come later on in the show, we're going to be hearing your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. We've had some fantastic debates recently, and we'll be hearing what you thought of them when we get towards the end of today's programme. So look forward to that. And if you want to get in touch yourself on today's show, again, you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also follow me on Facebook and Twitter at UnbelievableJB on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. I'm constantly posting updates, including updates on Unbelievable, the conference. And now if you're into philosophy and that kind of thing, you're going to have a real treat because we've got well-known Christian philosopher William Lane Craig coming to the conference. Also, a rather last-minute addition to our lineup, and I didn't mention him earlier on, Tim McGrew, who's a philosopher over at Western Michigan University and took part in a very popular show recently debating atheist Peter Boghossian. He's passing through London as it happens that day. He's going to be popping his head into the conference and joining in one or two things. So really looking forward to that. So meet the man who caused such a stir a few weeks ago on the programme. That's all available to look at and to book into from the Unbelievable webpage, or just go straight to the event page. That's premier.org.uk reasonablefaith for Unbelievable Conference 2014 on Saturday, 12th of July in central London. It's with Biola University and in partnership with Reasons to Believe this year. So pleased to have people like Clay Jones, one of my guests on today's programme, coming over to be a speaker at this year's conference. Very exciting stuff. What are we talking about on today's show? The problem of evil. Perhaps the most common objection to Christianity is, why would an all good, all loving God allow so much evil and suffering in the world? Something I think a lot of regular people, it's not just a philosophical issue. It's something that probably everyone who calls themselves a Christian or a believer of some kind has wrestled with when they've been struck by tragedy or pain in a personal way, or seen it on in a large scale in some sort of tragedy around the world. Of course, many philosophers have tackled it down the centuries. Well, we heard in that last section, Richard, just a number of different ways in which Clay sketched out some of the defences he might bring to bear as to why God would have reasons for allowing evil and suffering. As he said, he's very clear that many of these are biblical reasons. He comes from a biblical worldview. He says, I believe in the God of the Bible, and therefore from that perspective there are reasons why the God of the Bible would allow evil and suffering. So we might want to touch on some of that as regards the issues around the fall and so on. But maybe we'll start out with what is, I think, has become a classic defence, the free will defence, as it's called. And to again paraphrase Clay slightly, it's this idea that God, it's a good thing, free will, but obviously people will use free will in bad ways, evil and suffering and so on. And God creates a world of free creatures in which these things can occur and so on. Do you want to start off on that, and we'll bring Clay in as
yes, let me comment on that. I mean, you know, up to a point, one can see what lies behind that argument. I mean, it's clearly the case that if you believe in a divine creator who has created human beings with free will, then it follows from that he's created beings who can misuse that free will, who can make wrong choices, who can make disastrous choices, who can screw things up. What that doesn't give a sufficient explanation of, I think, is why a benevolent God would create a world in which innocent human beings suffer so terribly for the misuse by other people of their free will. Mm. If a benevolent God, surely, who part of whose purpose was to create a world in which human beings would have to make their own moral choices, and indeed a world in which they learn from the mistakes and the wrong choices that they make, would create a world in which people's suffering was a result of their own misuse of their free choice. And it's perfectly possible to imagine a world in which an all-powerful, benevolent creator created a world in which suffering was proportional to people's misuse of their choice. What that doesn't explain, then, is why an omnipotent, benevolent creator would create a world in which there is so much terrible, unmerited suffering, where innocent people suffer as a result of the availability of moral choice.
Okay, Clay, so coming to you, any responses there to some of those issues that Richard raises in response to this free will defence?
Well, yes, I'd like to kid and say, no, that caught me completely off guard. I have no idea what to say. I've never heard that before. But anyway, be that as it may, let me just make I'll try to quickly, I could unpack these for a long time, and we can talk about it later, but I'll just make three quick points. Everybody needs to think through, how does God stop a lot of this, what people would call senseless suffering? In other words, does God not allow people to get drunk so that they don't kill others on the road? Does he not allow them to somehow he prevent them from texting so that they don't kill somebody on the road? When somebody pulls a gun on someone else, how does he stop that one person from killing another? How does he keep preventing this? Because, of course, we're not just talking about once or twice or a few times. We're talking about millions and millions and millions of of things where people are hurting each other, which we would call sometimes senseless anyway, millions of times every day. How does he prevent that without us going, wow, there's a God. Look, he's, you know, I mean, the miraculous is happening millions of times every day. My second comment would be just briefly, this one of the things that this does, for instance, Auschwitz, which is, of course, a classic example, Auschwitz does something for us, and that is it reveals to us how sinful, how evil humankind can be. That there's an amazing propensity for sinfulness in humankind that I think is best expressed by the fall of man. In fact, I make the argument that we were all born, everyone was born Auschwitz-enabled. That there's something just peculiarly evil. And I'll take, just let me give very quickly two pieces of evidence for that. Every single researcher of genocide that I've ever read, and I've read a lot of them, and, well, the other piece of evidence, and every victim of genocide I've ever read, from Alexander Solzhenitsyn and the Gulag Archipelago to Elie Wiesel, agrees that it's the average person of a population that commits Auschwitz. It's the average person. In other words, people that commit these heinous atrocities are not unusually depraved or sadistic, that they're just normal folks, that average people do genocide when they think they have half a reason. This is valuable information to humankind about that God actually puts up with humankind is amazing. And my last thing is, of course, and this is valuable for heaven because God's teaching us, look what happens when free beings go wrong. When free beings go wrong, they do Auschwitz.
And in a sense, the reason you bring that up is just to point out that humanity has this propensity. And that if God were to be constantly overriding that propensity, we wouldn't be human at some level.
Is that... And even non-Christians like George Krenn, I should take that back. I'm not for sure. But historian George Krenn and psychologist Leon Rappaport wrote about the Holocaust. And I'll just read you one sentence. They said, "What remains is a central deadening sense of despair over the human species. Where can one find an affirmative meaning in life if human beings can do such things?" And this is typical of all those who've done a tremendous amount of genocide studies. They go, humans aren't good. Well, they asked, where can one find an affirmative meaning in life? Well, you know, you can't. Very simply, if you really understand how evil humankind is, except God came and allowed his son to be tortured to death to pay for humankind's sin so that they can be forgiven of their evil propensities and the sins that they commit.
Let's tackle this one at a time then. Firstly, I think we've got this issue, Richard, that Clay says, well, okay, yes, there may appear to be a lot of unmerited suffering in terms of those who suffer at the hands of other people's free choices. But if God were to intervene, how many millions and billions of choices every day would have to be overridden? And this is, you know, comes to the core of the free will argument that God is willing to allow those evils because people's free will is a greater good that needs protecting at some level.
Yeah, let me clarify that point. I mean, the point I'm raising there when I say why could a benevolent God not create human beings with free will where they suffered for their own wrong choices? I'm not making the non-intervention point. I'm saying why doesn't God constantly intervene to prevent, for example, drunk drivers from killing children? We're supposed to be talking about an omnipotent God here. So we're not asking, you know, why doesn't God step in all the time? We're asking, why couldn't such a divine creator, an omnipotent and benevolent divine creator, have created a different world from this one in which the good of free will existed, but in which there wasn't this massive amount of unmerited suffering on the part of the innocent? So it's not a point about individual interventions in particular cases. The examples that Clay uses there presuppose the kind of world that we've got. But if you believe in an omnipotent and benevolent God, then you've got to ask, why did God not create a better world than this one? one in which the innocent don't suffer.
There is overall less suffering by the innocent.
One in which the innocent don't suffer, where there is free will, but the innocent don't suffer.
Can you have such a world, Clay, as far as you're concerned?
You know, one of the things, I love this conversation, and I wish we could unpack this for the next 2 hours, just this topic right here, because people say, well, God should have just somehow made the world differently. Yeah, sure. And what I do when I have time to really unpack it is I say, okay, now, and what exactly did you have in mind? And people go, well, I don't know. I'm not God. And I go, whoa. You're complaining that God should have arranged the world differently, and I'm asking you, tell me how it works, how he does arrange this world differently and still allow beings to have significant amount of free will.
Why isn't that a sufficient description? It would be a world in which people made bad choices, wrong choices, and suffered for their own choices. Why is that not a sufficient description? Don't forget, we're talking about omnipotence here.
I'm sorry, but I kind of just a little bit missed what you said there. Could you probably
Your question was, what would this world be like? And my answer is simply a world in which there is the good of human free will, but in which people suffer only for their own misuse of free will. Now, it's answering that by describing a world in which people get drunk and drive cars and run people over. We're talking about divine omnipotence and any number of different worlds that such a being could create. That's a perfectly consistent description of such a world, to say it's a world in which human beings exercise free will, but they only suffer from their own exercise of free will.
The key, I guess, back to my major point is that doesn't just saying it should have been a different world doesn't tell us how anywhere near how that world works.
Well, look, I'm not a divine creator.
I keep saying we're talking about divine omnipotence
in which any number of possible worlds could exist.
I guess my point, Richard, is to just simply go, God could have devised a world with significant free will where beings wouldn't hurt each other. They'd only hurt themselves. Mm-hmm. And I say, how would that work? And go, well, I don't know. I'm not God. Mm-hmm. I'd say, well, wait a minute. I don't think that world's possible. And I challenge people that say no, you need to tell me exactly how that works. How a man could shoot himself, but he couldn't shoot somebody else.
Yeah, you're giving examples from our world, you know, in which people shoot one another.
But isn't the whole point of free will? If I can jump in here, gentlemen, to come in on Clay's side here, I suppose, Richard, that it is very difficult to conceptualize any type of free will which doesn't inevitably have an impact beyond the person, individual, anything that is significantly freely willed. In that sense, if what you're asking is for Clay to suggest some kind of a effectively logically impossible world, isn't that setting the bar? It's not a logically impossible world,
it's a world which, of course, we can't describe. We don't know what it would be like. But it's not logically impossible.
I think we can't describe it because it's logically impossible.
No. I've just given a logically consistent description of it.
When you ask how
would it work, that's not saying it's logically impossible. It's just saying, you know, with our limited imaginations, we can't imagine what it would be like.
Well, I just encourage people, I encourage the listener to think this through and say God should have made the world differently. Hmm. Okay, how? And people go, well, I don't know. I'm not God. And I go, well, you know what? I don't know how you don't want me to use guns because that's from our world. I don't know how God logically creates a world where humans have significant amount of free will, but they can never use that free will to harm anybody but themselves. I don't know how you can construct such a world. And that's my point. And to just simply go, well, I don't know.
If I could come in again, I mean, one way in which I can see that it's almost logically impossible to construct such a world, personally, Richard, just off the top of my not very philosophically trained head, is that if in a world of free will, love is a good, even if your free will, your selfish act of free will only harms yourself, is it not inevitable that if I love you or anyone, if there are loving relationships in such a world, the person who sees that suffering happen to someone, it will have a negative effect on them? So it's almost impossible for me to somehow divide, you know, to suggest that free will could only apply to
We're arguing from the kind of world that we know, a world in which there is such a thing as love. And you know, and of course, in a world where there is love, people are capable of hurting one another. I mean, we can imagine possible worlds till the cows come home. I think, I mean, you know, in the end, again, the point, as we've said earlier, is that there's not a logical contradiction here, but the kind of world that we're describing, in which the exercise of free will has these terrible consequences, is not the sort of world of which one would naturally say this must be the work of a loving creator. It has all the appearances of a flawed world in which we pay the price for free will, we pay the price for being creatures who can love, we pay the price for being creatures who make moral choices. But all of that sounds to me like the description of a flawed, imperfect world, which could be the creation of some kind of God, but doesn't sound to me like the creation of the kind of world that Christians believe in.
If you're going to create that world, however, I'd love to hear how that actually, how that would actually work. But we just leaving that aside for a second, you'd be creating a world where beings are significantly less free. And what I mean is, a being that can hurt himself only is less free than a being that can hurt himself, and if he chooses to use his free will wrongly, hurt a whole bunch of other people too. That's a world that's less free. And that's basically where I've heard atheists go regularly. Well, God should have basically created a world where humans are less free. And that's a very different thing. I like the freedom that we have in this world. And let me just bring in one point, because I have to say before the program ends, with eternity will dwarf our suffering here to insignificance. And that always has to be borne in mind. With all of the evil and horrors that there are here, eternity will dwarf all of that to insignificance.
Well, we could come, maybe we could come back to the eternity argument. But just to pick up that previous point, though, your position there seems to be, given that the exercise of free will is a good thing, then the more free will people can exercise, the better. I don't think that follows. Surely a world in which people can exercise free will but don't hurt one another so much would be a better world.
See, I noticed you just qualified it by so much. If people, the question is, can people hurt each other or not? And anyway, this is a typical thing where this conversation tends to go, and that is, like I say, how free should people be? I think God...
I don't think it's a terribly meaningful question, quite honestly.
Okay, well, anyway, God, from biblically, God chose to create beings with a significant amount of free will, because he likes beings that have free will. By the way, I've written an article entitled Sci-Fi, Free Will, and the Problem of Evil in the Christian Research Journal, and it's interesting to me that science fiction films, The Terminator, The Matrix, for that matter, Blade Runner and on, they always, regardless of how much evil results in the world, they always conclude that humankind is better off having free will because free will is valuable. And so I think when people start to say, yeah, but we should be created so that we're less free, well, we could unpack that, like I say, for quite a long time, but I'm glad that I am in relationship with significantly free beings. That yes, these free beings can harm each other, but I'm glad that I'm surrounded by these beings that have the significant free will, because when you have the significant chance to do good and evil, see, the chance to do good then is also hugely greater in a world where people can seriously injure each other than in a world where they can't, because people then can have courage and self-sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Well, that takes us to a different argument. Yeah, sure.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's okay. Yeah. But the bottom line is significant freedom's important, and this is what the atheist has to do again and again and say, well, he doesn't have to give us this much freedom. He can make us a lot less.
What we didn't quite get to, and I'd just be interested in your quick response to this as well, Richard, is this other point that Clay made about people are evil, basically. Everything seems to show that even mass atrocities are committed by basically normal people. Now, I think the point you were kind of driving at there,
the Clay, Auschwitz argument. Yeah. Well, there's a sense in which terrible atrocities like that couldn't happen unless there were ordinary people who did terrible things. It's not the ordinary people who created the evil of Auschwitz, but people went along with it. But okay, there's, you know, up to a point that there's a significant claim there to be made about the flawed nature of ordinary people. But to say that that somehow makes something like Auschwitz okay is to...
I just have to say, I don't think Auschwitz is
all right,
okay.
To create a world in which there are phenomena like Auschwitz, and to say that's a world created by a loving God, isn't it to attribute to that loving God some kind of doctrine of collective punishment, that because a lot of ordinary people are pretty flawed beings and do terrible things, that explains why there's a world in which there are places like Auschwitz where innocent children go to their deaths because of the wrongs done by flawed ordinary people.
Well, yeah, God created, of course, God didn't create, God, you're right, God created a world that would allow Auschwitz, mm-hmm. that's correct, mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. God created a world where humans would have significant amount of free will. But see, we're learning something from Auschwitz, and that is we're learning how it's not just Auschwitz, the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, mm-hmm. what happened in China mm-hmm. under Mao, the many millions killed there, Soviet Union, Rwanda, mm-hmm. and on and on and on, that disappeared in Argentina. We're learning, for that matter, the tremendous amount of abortion that occurs where people are, you know, millions and millions of children are being killed. We're learning that humankind isn't good when they're on their own, that they get intoxicated by their, hey, I'm my own being and I can do what I want. And that's a valuable lesson for all of eternity.
So this feeds into this eternal sort of argument at some level then, because you feel even though these acts and so on are create terrible suffering for many people, they're as it were part of this free will that has been given to people, but there's also some ultimate purpose to which they kind of contribute, which is that they are in some sense we learn from about our own humanity, about our own fallenness, our wretchedness, and so on, that in a way that ultimately is for the good. Is this kind of where you're going with that, Clay?
That would be correct, absolutely. I think God's plan is to give us free will in heaven, yet we won't be tempted to rebel because we're learning here the horror of rebellion. We're learning here this is what beings do when they decide to go off on their own and be their own little gods. And that's what you have, is people deciding to be their own little gods. And these own little gods, when other people get in their way, they tend to kill them. And often they tend to kill them in very terrible ways. But those who say, you know what, I don't think this people being their little gods works. I want to submit myself to the creator of the universe. Those people are going to be the people that are going to be in heaven, and they're going to be able to have free will and not use it to rebel, because they're going to go, you know what, rebellion really is a really cruddy life to live. We've been there, done that. Let's not do that anymore.
Just a quick response, Richard, before we have to go
well,
to
let's
our
just,
final
let's
break.
Well, let's just say a little about the learning argument. To say part of the purpose, I mean, I know it's only part of your argument, but to say part of the purpose of this terrible suffering is so that we can learn from it sounds to me like an incredibly callous point of view. I mean, imagine, you know, a powerful ruler, let's say, who, you know, creates a world, a society in which terrible things happen to people, and says, but that's okay because they will learn from it. They will learn how bad it is to rebel. They will learn how bad it is to misuse their freedom. So that's some kind of justification for creating a world, a society in which people starve, people die of terrible diseases. They'll learn from it.
You know, at this point, I should bring up C.S. Lewis made the, you know, because we talk about this huge amount, like the incommensurate amount of human suffering. And mm-hmm. Lewis brought up the analogy. He says, if I'm in a dentist's office with the toothache of intensity X, and you're in the same office with a toothache of intensity X, you can say that the total amount of pain in the world is 2X, but no one suffers 2X. The amount of pain that one person suffers in the world is surely a lot of suffering. But once we get to the amount of pain that one person can suffer, that's all the suffering that occurs in the world. And then you put that in the context of eternal life, that these people are going to live, turn to Jesus, and you're going to live forever and ever and ever and ever, and that will dwarf our sufferings here to insignificance.
That's going away from the learning argument and to the eternity argument.
It's part of the learning argument. I mean, because you're learning, wow, evil is really horrible. Mm. God was right all along. Mm. We should obey him after all.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back for Richard to make another response and before we start to wrap things up. You're listening to a really interesting discussion today on the problem of evil here on Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Clay Jones and Richard Norman in conversation today. Clay is our Christian, Richard our atheist on today's show. Hope you're enjoying it here on Premier Christian Radio. We'll be concluding their discussion in a moment's time and be hearing some of your feedback to previous week's programming. Do catch up again in a moment.
Do the Bible and science really contradict each other? Is there really a historical Adam and Eve? These are only a few of the questions that seem to indicate an apparent conflict between science and faith, and this is why Reasons to Believe exists. RTB's mission is to demonstrate that sound reason and scientific research consistently support, rather than erode, confidence in the truth of the Bible. Our work shows how the record of nature and the record of Scripture reveal the God of the Bible as Creator, Lord, and Savior. Find out how you also can give a skeptical world reasons to believe. Visit us today at reasons.org.
Welcome back to part three of Unbelievable, and we'll be concluding our discussion on the problem of suffering and evil in just a moment's time. Just time to tell you, though, that if you're continuing listening later on today on Premier Radio, you'll be able to hear the profile between 4 and 5. Exciting guest joining Anthony Aris Osula today, Stephen Baldwin of the Baldwin Acting Dynasty, and he'll be talking about his life of faith and his work in movies and TV as well. So there's a really interesting guest for you. Between 4 and 5 today. Also to come later on today's show, we're going to be hearing your feedback. Why did one person think that it was a nil-nil draw a couple of weeks ago between Christian scientist Jeff Zwiering and atheist scientist Steve Jones? Also, one of Steve Jones' students has been in touch as well. So some interesting responses to that. And of course, last week's programme on paradoxology between Krishkan Dyer and Tony Smollett, some responses to that as well. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find out other ways to get in touch on the social media and links to my guests today from the website. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to Unbelievable, the conference as well, in 3 weeks' time. Not only have we got Clay on today's show, who's one of our contributors, but next week it's my pleasure to be joined by Oz Guinness, who's our keynote speaker for Unbelievable, the conference this year. And he's going to be giving the opening address. He's also going to be speaking in some of the seminars as well. So he's going to be with me again with an ex-Christian next week. That's going to be a discussion on sort of why we get doubts as Christians, what we do with them, and why Oz has continue to remain a Christian, why my other guest next week, Ed Atkinson, has chosen the path of atheism. So that will be an interesting discussion, same time, same place next week. For the moment, let's get into the final part of today's programme.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So just concluding our conversation today on the problem of evil, something we've tackled before on the show, but not sort of very specifically in the way we have today. It often comes up in the course of all kinds of discussions in one way or another. But we've really been drilling down at a philosophical level today on the whether the existence of evil defeats belief in God. Well, Richard Norman earlier on in the programme said it's not logically impossible to have a God and have the world as we see it, but it's improbable. He said, and he differs from Clay Jones, my Christian guest on the show today, in as much as he doesn't believe you can find a way through with a so-called theodicy, a way of coming to see the reasons God may have for allowing evil. And that's where our conversation has taken us, whether things like genocide and great evils in the world could be allowed by God for some greater purpose, whether it be
allowing for free will in the world, or whether it be because there may be some greater lesson that is being learned in the long run. You gave this analogy, Richard, that it seems a bit like a dictator or a ruler, you know, sort of playing almost an experiment mm-hmm. In his land, you know, mm-hmm. to create a set mm-hmm. of conditions where people are given enough free will to completely mess their lives up, but he stands back and doesn't do anything that he could do to intervene, because he says, no, it's a learning
it's
thing.
Good
it's good for you
it.
To mm-hmm. learn from this. Mm-hmm. Clay, is that a fair analogy for what you're saying?
In a sense, you know, it's funny. When you use the word dictator, it's kind of an interesting dictator in this sense. Because it's a dictator, I mean, that says, be free. That's a weird, a dictator that says, be free. You are free. And so that's
it's a dictator who says, be free, but you'll suffer if you use your freedom in this kind of way.
Yes, thank you for that, Richard. I agree with you. Yeah, mm-hmm. be free, but if you use your free will wrongly, you're really going to hurt each other. It's going to be bad.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
exactly.
But isn't the problem with your position precisely that you make God sound like some kind of dictator? That's just the problem with your position,
well,
isn't it?
A dictator that says, do what you want. And here we are, doing what we want.
No, do what you want and you will suffer for it.
Well, do what you want and look what you'll do. You'll do Auschwitz to each other. Mm-hmm. You'll be the Khmer Rouge. You'll be Rwanda. This is what happens when free beings go off and decide they're going to do whatever they want. And so to say he's a dictator that says to his people, okay, you don't want to follow my rules? Knock yourselves out and see
dictator,
how you
dictator wasn't my word. I think I may have been
the one responsible. But in a sense, I think Richard has kind of fairly, you know, outlined the issue there. And I suppose, Clay, for you, it simply is the case that actually there may be a better good for people to learn from their mistakes than for that ruler to intervene and say, no, I'm not going to let you make the mistakes. I'm going to make sure that you don't run around killing each other and so on. Because in the long run, that's not going to produce the kind of ultimate society that ruler perhaps is looking for in some way?
Yes, let me just, I think I could sum it up like this. God says, you should follow my rules. I know best. Humankind said, you know what? We really don't think you know best. God says, okay, knock yourselves out and see how you like it. And it turns out that humankind then does Auschwitz. And then they complain, God shouldn't have given us so much freedom. Huh? Anyway, that's, now we can argue about God should allow less evil than he does. But if you say mm-hmm. that God shouldn't allow people to even hurt each other, you're talking about creating beings that are significantly less free. And then you have the problem of how does God do that anyway? Through millions and millions and millions of daily miracles where he just simply, you know, doesn't let people get drunk and drive, that he doesn't let people pull the trigger on themselves and not on somebody else. How does he do that?
I'm not talking about a world in which a better world will be one where God's constantly intervening. All I'm saying is that a world in which there is the terrible suffering that people, partly through their own activities, partly through natural disasters, partly through the way that the world is, suffer terribly in unmerited ways, that's not the sort of world of which one would naturally think, that must have been created by an all-loving God. I think this is at the heart of it. You know, there are ways in which you can try to reconcile it, but none of those would be the natural explanation for why there is the kind of world that we see around us, a world in which there is massive unmerited suffering.
Would you take a lead from people like Plantinga, Clay? Because I think he suggested effectively that if we're talking about possible world, he said, well, what if this is the best possible world?
Because I think it is the best possible world.
And what's your justification for saying that?
My justification for that is because God wants us to learn. Well, there's a lot, okay. You know, obviously. Let me just finish my sentence here.
All right.
This is the best possible world because God wanted to create beings with significant free will, and he wants us to learn the horror of rebellion, which we're learning in this world, and then he intends to fix it all with eternal life forever and ever with those who give their lives over to him. And I'd argue that this is the best possible world. I don't know, you know, that's a very philosophical, you know, I mean, very speculative statement. What's the best possible world? I think this is a great possible world. And remember, for all the suffering we're talking about, it is only a blip compared to eternity. It is 0% of eternity. We're going to live forever and ever and ever, and God's going to fix it and dwarf our suffering by eternity. Will dwarf our suffering to insignificance.
And I've also heard Plantinga sort of make the point, in a sense, that a world in which God comes and redeems through Jesus Christ,
right,
can only happen in a world where there is suffering and evil to redeem. In that sense,
you know, I'm glad you brought that up, Justin, because if Christianity is true, God allowed Himself, God the Son, to allowed Himself to have others torture Him to death. We can't lose sight of that. He understands what's going on with evil. He allowed God the Son to be tortured to death to pay for the sinful evil that humans do.
I want to put this in human terms, actually, if I may, and I want to pick up your phrase about the best possible world, and I want to give you an actual human example, just one that from my experience recently. I went to a concert a week ago in memory of a young man who was an incredibly talented pianist, one of a family in which the parents had problems with some of the other children. He was the apple of their eye, an incredibly talented young man, a joy to be with, loved by everybody. And this was a concert in memory of him because he died of cancer at the age of 21. Are you going to say of a world in which that happens, that's the best possible world that there could be?
I don't know how a better one could be created and still give beings free will. You know,
what's his death from cancer got to do with free will?
At the age of
21.
The answer to that is that when Adam and Eve used their free will wrongly, God then cursed the ground, enabling every kind of pestilence, which includes cancer, and then remove them from the rejuvenating power of the tree of life. Because frankly, once humankind rebels and decides, you know what, we're going to do our own things now, God is not obligated to give them a long, happy life where they'll die. See, the Lord didn't say on the day that you eat of it, you will die in your sleep at a ripe old age of natural causes. He just said you will die. And we've been attending funerals ever since. This is what happens to rebellion for those that are rebellious.
But we're not talking about somebody who's rebellious. We're talking about someone who lived a good life, irradiated the world around him and died of cancer at 21. How does a story about Adam and Eve provide a justification for saying that that's the best possible world?
Well, only one thing is going to prevent us from watching absolutely every single person we know die from murder, accident, or disease.
No, I'm not talking about the fact
that
we're mortal.
Richard, you're not letting me get my sentences
finished. Right.
The only thing that's going to prevent us from watching every single person we know die from murder, accident, or disease is going to be our own death from murder, accident, or disease. Because the human condition is we're all going to die. Whether someone dies at 30 or 60 or 90, we're all going to die, and we're all going to watch everyone else die before we die. That's the human condition. But God sent his son Jesus to fix that. And you can say, well, God, you know, I mean, when we start to do this, well, he shouldn't have died at 30. Well, should he have died at 60? I'm sure people go, well, no, he shouldn't have died at 60. Well, what age should people be allowed to die? I mean, this starts to be very... And when somebody dies young, by the way, it serves everybody else. Everybody else learns something that we don't. Wait, one last thing that we don't like, but is really valuable, and that is, guess what? We're all vulnerable to death at any time, and that helps us to be aware of our ultimate destination, which is death, and of course, from the Christian worldview, then judgment. But if this guy died knowing Jesus, I guarantee you he's living forever and ever and ever and ever. And the fact that he died at 30 from cancer is very, very comparatively small. I'm not saying it's not horrible. I've had cancer.
Yeah.
I've had bone cancer. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that comparatively it's very small.
We are going to have to start to draw it to a close, and appreciate the back and forth that you've had, gentlemen, on this. Wish we had more time to go into it, because it feels like, you know, we were just broaching some important stuff there, in a sense. But thank you very much for being on the line, Clay, and for being with me in studio here, Richard, for this discussion. And if you want, people want to find out more, as I mentioned, about Richard, humanism.org. He's part of the Humanist Philosophers Group, vice president of the British Humanist Association. ClayJones.net for more on Clay. And, of course, he's coming to this year's conference as well. Find out more at premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. Clay, thanks for being on the line today. And we look forward to seeing you in just a few weeks' time.
Thank you, Justin, and thank you for the vigorous conversation, Richard. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to have you too, Richard. Thanks for coming
Thanks
in again.
Thank you.
Perhaps we'll see you again in due course as well. It's good of you to take some time to come into our studio today. And, well, if you're listening and you'd like to comment on today's programme, as ever, unbelievable@premier.org.uk to get in touch. Be happy to read out your emails on next week's show about today's subject. I'm sure we're going to get a hefty mailbag in response to this one. And we're going to hear some of your comments in just a moment's time anyway in regard to recent shows on things like the issues of science and faith we've talked about recently, the Catholic Church, the issue of how we define faith, and much more besides. So do stick around this Saturday afternoon as we look at some of your feedback to previous editions of the programme. And don't forget to find this programme online and all the details about how you can find out more about my guests by visiting premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thanks for your emails and for getting in touch via social media as well in the last week or two. Anthony in the USA says, I won't be able to travel to the UK for your conference this year. Will there be any other way of seeing it for those outside the country? There will, Anthony. I'm glad you asked. We are going to be putting a DVD and CD package together of Unbelievable, the conference this year. And we'll make sure you're very much aware of that if you're a listener once the conference is over, so that you can get hold of that. Because even those who go to the conference simply can't attend all the seminars because they run concurrently, if you like. There's three to choose from in each seminar stream at a time. And so many people sort of say, oh, I wished I could have gone to that as well as this one. And well, we sort that out by putting it on DVD and CD afterwards. So we're looking forward to producing that, and we'll make sure that you know how to get hold of it once those are available after the conference. If you are coming along to the conference, though, it'll be lovely to see you in 3 weeks' time. Just a reminder that you can book more than one ticket and get hold of that Biola DVD that we're offering for more than one ticket booked. But anyone coming to the conference, any person coming as a delegate, will receive the Reasonable Faith DVD. That was just confirmed in this last week, that that's going to be going into every delegate pack that gets handed out at the beginning of the day. So that's exciting. It's going to include videos from some of Bill's talks and indeed his debates as well, such as the Cambridge Union debate that he had when he was over for the Reasonable Faith tour a couple of years ago. Exciting stuff. And if you want to book in for the conference, if you want to get your place in there, make sure you don't leave it too late. I know lots of people do tend to book in late for these sorts of things these days, but maybe you've been sitting on your hands and not quite done it yet. Do go to the website, check out the material, check out the speakers, the seminars, and all that's going on, and then book in. premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. It's going to be a fantastic year this year. Some great speakers. So looking forward to having William Lane Craig back in the country to address us. Oz Guinness is going to be fantastic, and I'm looking forward to him joining me next week here on the programme. And thanks for all of you who have been getting in touch in one way or another. Mike Ranieri on last week's programme, where Krish Kandaya of the Evangelical Alliance, he's an author and speaker, was talking about his new book, Paradoxology. What do we do with some of the paradoxes of the Christian faith? Are they simply contradictions, or could they be pathways to truth? He was in conversation with atheist Tony Smollett. A lot of people really appreciating that dialogue and discussion last week. Lots of good comments on Twitter, especially from people who tuned in for that. Mike, though, is a Christian out in Toronto in Canada, says it is inevitable that when discussing biblical paradox, the issue of free will comes up. I find it interesting that the free will theodicy, which obviously was mentioned on today's show as well, Mike, you say it's interesting that which as so many apologists find it compelling and strong, is, as pointed out by Krish, not found in the Bible. This discussion often lacks a clear definition of free will. It's important because I think the concept of free will is itself a paradox, and libertarian free will and determinism are not the only choices. Compatibilism needs to be considered and understood. I think most determinists, like Sam Harris, are really compatibilists. Consider this. If our definition of free will is that one must be free to choose either good or evil, then not even God has free will, because God, in his very nature, cannot sin. Indeed, and I think where you may be coming from that, Mike, is a sort of a Calvinist perspective, where if there is free will, it is of this compatibilist kind. And that's the kind of free will that many people who are otherwise determinists as atheists sort of would advocate for if they think of anything like free will. But we haven't sort of really done free will in that strictly philosophical sense before on the programme, and perhaps it is time to get one of those more technical discussions going in that direction. Thank you for getting in touch. Also on the Paradoxology show of last week, Graham says, analogies are dangerous. Krish Kandaya used the wave-particle duality of the photon with reference to the divine-human duality of Christ. Well, the point to note here is that the photon's duality is taken to mean that the photon is neither a particle nor a wave, says Graham. So he says, be careful of the analogies we use. I guess all analogies break down at some level, don't they? I was just posted a video on my Facebook page last week because it was Trinity Sunday, and it was called St. Patrick's Bad Analogies, in which in a cartoon form he addresses two of the pagan Irish that he's come to convert on the issues of the Trinity, and they give him a schooling in why his analogies simply don't stand up to claims of heresy. But anyway, it's quite fun. Derek says, going back now to the Steve Jones and Jeff Zwierink debate of a couple of weeks ago on science and scripture, you felt Jeff struggled to grasp why an atheist would trust reason. He said, what is the basis for trusting that anything that comes out of our mind has any sort of bearing on what is actually true? Why can I trust what it thinks to be true? And my answer would be, we can't, not from an a priori theoretical point of view. If our ideas match reality, then we have evidence for them to be true. If not, we're mistaken. It's about empiricism, not theorizing. Thank you very much. I mean, that kind of took us in. We didn't really have time to develop that. And I'm not sure either whether Steve Jones particularly clocked the direction Jeff was going in terms of that. But obviously people like Alvin Plantinga have suggested that on a purely naturalistic evolutionary framework, it's the idea of us developing truth, sort of truthful ideas with these cognitive faculties we have, is questionable, because that's not what they're geared towards doing. They're geared towards survival, the brain, as it were, in a purely evolutionary sense, rather than producing true beliefs. Ian says, hi, Justin. Listening to the debate between Jeff Zwierink and Steve Jones, I'd score this a nil-nil draw. I usually score by the number of times I'm led to go, maybe it was the boundary conditions of the debate that closed it down. There are so many scientific questions that could have been discussed. How do prayers get from the physical world to the spiritual world? What is the transport method? In miracles, where does the energy come from, assuming miracles result in an increase in entropy? How is the energy controlled, etc.? Like I said, so many questions. Love the show. This is a genuine comment made under no obligation. Thanks, Ian. Interesting to hear from you. I guess, in a sense, when it comes to the miraculous, something that is coming from outside the physical world at some level, one, I think the way John Lennox has put it is that it's the idea is it's the designer feeding in a new event into the system, if you like. And I guess if you are the designer of the system, you are at liberty to add to or decrease the entropy and energy and so on, if that's what it takes. But I guess if you're God, that wouldn't be beyond you. Loved the show, says James Hill, but I wanted to pull my teeth out when no one objected to the assertion that the Genesis account matches the scientific account of the origin of the universe and the earth. The Genesis account talks about earthly light without the sun, plant life growing without a sun, the moon being its own source of light, etc., all ideas that don't match scientific evidence. This leads me back to my assertion that religion and science are difficult to reconcile, because where science asks a question and follows evidence to its conclusion, religion begins with a conclusion and searches for compatible evidence. That's not to say scientists can't be religious, but any scientist knows that if you start with a conclusion, you're doing it the wrong way. Thank you very much. You ask, as a side question, seeing as you sometimes play atheist advocate on the show, do you find any arguments about God, against God and religion, compelling? That is a big question and not one I've time to deal with. But thank you, James. And I'll try to answer that one day. What are the best arguments, in my view, against God? Just in terms of whether the Genesis account matches the sort of the general progression of the way science sees life developing on Earth. I've seen people like Andrew Parker, for instance, who's a scientist in Oxford, who's an agnostic, but has actually come to the conclusion that actually read in a particular way. Actually, there is a quite distinct correlation between the emergence of life on Earth and the Genesis account because obviously you get light in as much as God said, let there be light, and there was light. So light is there sort of from the outset at some level. But this thing of setting the lights in the sky and so on, someone like him would say that could refer to, for instance, the point at which sea life began to become photoreceptive, as it were, and actually sea lights. So there are different ways of understanding it. Anyway, good to have your interactions. I've got a couple more here on that Tim McGrew and Peter Boghossian debate as well, but looks like we're running out of time, so might have to leave those for another time. But thank you, Grace Dalton, who got in touch over that, and Joseph Webb as well, who wanted to talk about those issues. It's been really interesting to receive all your feedback on that very popular Tim McGrew and Peter Boghossian episode of a few weeks ago now. If you haven't heard already, Tim McGrew, who's from Western Michigan University, he's a Christian philosopher, is going to be joining us. He happens to be in London on Saturday, the 12th of July, for the conference. So he'll be popping in. He'll be sharing a seminar with David Robertson on engaging with atheism. He's going to be around to interact with in the breaks and so on. So we're looking forward to having him there with us, as well as a sort of a bonus addition to our lineup. So do book in now, just 3 weeks away. Unbelievable, the conference 2014. And I promise once it's over, I'll stop going on about it. But in the meantime, do book in premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith for this year's conference, put in conjunction with Biola and Reasons to Believe. OK, let me tell you what's coming up on next week's show, if you can come back again at the same time here on Premier Christian Radio. You're unbelievable. We're going to be having Oz Guinness here in studio along with Ed Atkinson. Ed is a former Christian, now sees himself as an atheist. We'll be hearing about his journey of coming to doubt his faith and what the factors were involved in that, particularly just the fact that he didn't feel like he had any experience of God. And we'll be hearing what Oz Guinness's response is to that. He's someone with a wealth of experience in talking to atheists and skeptics around the world, and he's going to be interacting on next week's programme with Ed. So hope you can come back for that. Oz Guinness and the ex-Christian next week here on Unbelievable. And I hope that you enjoy the rest of what we've got on offer this Saturday afternoon. Coming up next, Anthony Aris Osola speaks to Stephen Baldwin about his life of faith and his acting career. Until next week here on Unbelievable, we'll see you then.